This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Coming up on the program today, well, it's day 34, so we got that. Also, more peeks inside the economic mind of Donald Trump. And oh yeah, some modern monetary theory too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today the 24th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has taken until day 34 of the partial shutdown of the American government. But we came this morning to an interesting moment. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross was on CNBC talking about a bunch of things, tariffs, the Chinese trade talks, also the shutdown, of course. And he was asked about the economic damage it's doing. I should tell you here, by the way, we are going to play this next piece of tape at length because Secretary Ross is a slow talker, but also because context is important. Here you go.
Put it in perspective. You're talking about 800,000 workers. And while I feel sorry for the individuals that have hardship cases, 800,000 workers, if they never got their pay, which is not the case, they will eventually get it. But if they never got it, you're talking about a third of a percent on our GDP. So it's not like it's a gigantic number overall.
I'm going to cut in here to point out that that's exactly what we were talking about yesterday. The White House is talking about the macroeconomic effects of this shutdown. The problem, of course, is that people live in the microeconomic day-to-day. All right, we're going to pick it up now, right where Secretary Ross left off. The first voice you're going to hear is Andrew Ross Sorkin of CNBC asking the questions.
Mr. Secretary, there are reports that there are some federal workers who are going to homeless shelters to get food.
Well, I know they are, and I don't really quite understand why, because as I mentioned before, the obligations that they would undertake, say a borrowing from a bank or a credit union, are in effect federally guaranteed. So the 30 days of pay that some people will be out, there's no real reason why they shouldn't be able to get a loan against it.
Again, that was long. Both of them were. But I wanted to make sure that Secretary Ross's comments were presented fairly, because one of the things that's becoming apparent the longer the shutdown goes on, and frankly, the more the White House and its advisors talk about it, is that the people running the executive branch don't really know much about the people who work in the executive branch. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman for a government workforce primer.
The median income of a furloughed federal worker is about $67,000 a year, according to Centier Research, which is just about what furloughed USDA IT technician Michael Galletly makes, or would make if his agency wasn't shut down. Galletly has some savings, so he's not desperate yet.
I'm probably going to have to apply for the same kind of aid unemployed people get with the gas bill. We were going to buy a car, but now we're using that money to pay the mortgage and the electric bill.
Galletly is in better shape financially than a lot of other furloughed folks, says Andrew Challenger at outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas.
About 75% of those workers are working paycheck to paycheck.
Challenger says workers have missed about $3.5 billion in total take-home pay so far. Here are a few other facts about federal workers. First, 18% are African American, compared to just 13% in the workforce overall, says Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation. He says these tend to be jobs with good wages and benefits.
Those are communities that are income constrained and employment constrained, and this loss is going to hit those communities hard.
Finally, about one in three federal workers is represented by a union, compared to less than one in 10 in the private sector. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The other bit of news out of Secretary Ross's interview this morning was that the United States and China, and this is a quote, are miles and miles apart on talks about a trade deal. We have been in a trade war of one variety or another going on 10 or 11 months now, ever since President Trump announced those steel and aluminum tariffs back on the 1st of March. We're doing a segment this week on the program, our top 10 moments of how President Trump has changed or tried to change the way we talk and think about the economy in this country. We're up to number 6 today. And I should say, if you missed 1 through 5, they're at marketplace.org. But number 6 is a tweet from the day after the president started our trade wars in motion, March the 2nd, 2018.
When a country, USA, is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win. Example, when we are down $100 billion with a certain country and they get cute, don't trade anymore. We win big. It's easy.
Catherine Rampell is an opinion columnist for The Washington Post. Also one of our Friday regulars. Here is her thought.
A year ago in March, Trump had this very famous tweet about how trade wars are good and easy to win, thereby revealing how little he understands about what, in fact, a trade war is, which is definitionally bad and everyone loses. It's like that famous movie from the 80s with Matthew Broderick, War Games, that the only winning move is not to play. And we have seen that since then. Their tariffs against us escalated. Our tariffs against them escalated. We are now in the middle of multiple trade wars, not just the one, which was basically what he was talking about at the time last March. And no one seems to be better off for it.
We're going to go back to back on Trumpian economic moments right now. Number 7 goes like this.
Billions of dollars are pouring into the coffers of the USA because of the tariffs being charged to China. And there is a long way to go. If companies don't want to pay tariffs, build in the USA. Otherwise, let's just make our country richer than ever before.
It is true that billions of dollars are flowing into the coffers of the USA, about $7 billion more last fiscal year than a year earlier. That's according to the Treasury Department. For some perspective, though, that is less than 0.2% of all the money the federal government collected last year. But the bigger point is that the tariffs aren't being paid by China, not by the Chinese government and not by Chinese companies. President Trump's tariffs, all president's tariffs, are paid by American consumers. Analysis by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York shows that tariffs last year bumped consumer inflation in this country about 0.3% higher. On Wall Street today, a little bit of a split decision. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The longer this shutdown goes on, the more obvious its effects are. And today's moment that you perhaps had not thought about, transit agencies that count on money from the Department of Transportation to operate their rail systems and maintain their existing and sometimes crumbling infrastructure. Well, with the partial government shutdown keeping the DOT closed, that money just ain't flowing, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
Walk onto a DC Metro subway car these days, and you might notice something kind of eerie.
More seats.
I've noticed that there are few commuters on a train by a pretty significant difference.
I kind of have the run of the metro to myself, which is rare, but also kind of strikingly sad.
That's Terrence Williams, who works at the World Bank, Jennifer Thompson, a federal employee, and Megan Reese, a freelance TV producer. Three D.C. area residents who've noticed the shutdown is keeping a lot of furloughed riders at home. Reese says it's making her nervous about the subway system she depends on.
And so I can absolutely believe that this is costing them revenue and ridership, and, you know, that will have a ripple effect long term.
In fact, the Metro says federal workers make up roughly 40% of its ridership. With ridership down, it says it's losing $400,000 a day in lost revenue. Ben Fried at the nonprofit Transit Center says agencies like the DC Metro can't afford those losses for very long.
The margins tend to be slim, and it doesn't take much to tip one agency's budget into the red for the year, which can trigger service cuts or fare hikes.
But it's not just lower ridership that's straining transit systems. The shutdown has also closed the Federal Transit Administration, which disburses $1 billion a month to local agencies across the country. Fried says that money is used for operations, maintenance, things like
repairing track, rehabbing buses, buying new buses, expanding rail lines. That's stuff that the federal government helps pay for, and right now there's no one to sign the checks.
Amtrak relies on federal subsidies from the Department of Transportation. So does the New York City Subway. It normally gets $150 million a month from Washington. Nick Cifuentes is the executive director of the Tri-State Transportation Campaign. He says this lapse in funding comes at a time when transit agencies are already in crisis.
There is a huge question right now as to how the state and local governments are going to come up with enough money to pay for all the transit fixes we need.
Agencies like New York's MTA still have to make ends meet. Cifuentes says transit systems are coming up with contingency plans.
What transit systems should do and are doing is basically lining up bridge loans and other kind of gap funding to make sure that they can cover the shortfalls from the federal government.
But borrowing more comes with risks, says Baruch Feigenbaum at the Reason Foundation.
Is there going to be effects on their credit ratings, for example? Are these transit agencies going to spend money on service and they're not performing maintenance or doing some of the needed checks that they need to do?
And it's not just trains and subways in the Northeast Corridor that are feeling the pinch. Small and mid-sized communities across the country depend on buses, and those rely heavily on federal funding. Feigenbaum says people who depend on the bus tend to have lower incomes, and they would feel the impact the most. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There has been a slew of media news this week, lots of journalism layoffs, and perhaps not unrelated, a decision by the big magazine publisher Condé Nast to pull all of its titles and put them behind a paywall. As Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports, sometimes the simplest explanation is the right explanation.
In 2017, Condé Nast lost more than $120 million. So the thinking here? Not too complicated. Just try to make some money. Right now, the publisher relies on ad revenue. And online, that is not super lucrative.
Advertising rates for digital have always been less than advertising rates for print.
Aileen Gallagher at Syracuse University says magazine and newspaper publishers have been trying to get around this problem by charging readers directly for events, for example. And yeah, for paywalls. And publishers have learned that paywalls pay. The Wall Street Journal and New York Times have had success with them, and so has Condé Nast, with Wired and The New Yorker, for example. Max Willens at the industry news website Digiday says paywalls make sense when a magazine does high-impact reporting.
When Ronan Farrow puts out a gigantic blockbuster story about Me Too, that's something that people might consider worth paying for.
But Willen says Condé Nast might have a harder time convincing online readers to pay for some of its lifestyle brands, like Allure and Glamour. Aileen Gallagher at Syracuse University says the publisher does have something going for it. We've all gotten used to paying for content online.
Netflix led the way with that, so people are comfortable with paying for streaming. People pay for music. And the idea that everything has to be free online is kind of an old one.
But Gallagher says by charging online readers, Condé Nast is going to face the same problem it's always faced in print. People only have so much time to read magazines. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Or listen to the radio. I'm just saying, you could listen to the radio. All right, today in You Paid How Much for That Apartment? $238 million from a hedge fund guy for 24,000 square feet spread over four floors of a new high-rise on Central Park South in Manhattan. It's the most expensive residence in this country ever, even as the New York City housing market is softening. You juxtapose that, as Marketplace Janet Babin does, with the number of people lining up for affordable housing in the city also breaking records.
The buyer of the most expensive home in the country is Citadel hedge fund founder Ken Griffin. Agent Sabrina Seidner is with the Corcoran Group, which represented the building's developer. She says the apartment probably doesn't look like your place.
360-degree views, floor-to-ceiling windows, Alabama limestone, you know, private health clubs, private dining rooms.
The sale is a throwback to the market of 3 years ago. That's when Griffin signed a contract to buy the unit. The deal closed now because the building's close to completion. Jonathan Miller tracks housing markets around the country.
It represents the heady days, the peak era of the super luxury development boom.
Miller says low interest rates fueled that boom and oversaturated the market. More than 15,000 luxury condos came online since 2015. Miller expects prices to fall in response to the glut. The middle of the market shows signs of softening, too. Last year, the median price for a New York City home dipped below $1 million for the first time in 3 years. Meanwhile, low- and middle-income New Yorkers continue to struggle to find housing. Martin Dunn develops affordable units in the city. He says demand for his apartments in 2018 was higher than it's ever been.
We had one last year where we got more than 80,000 applications for 37 apartments.
The Central Park condo is reportedly the third multi-million dollar home purchase for Ken Griffin this year. He also bought homes in London and Chicago. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's an approach to economics and to understanding the way that a modern economy works.
Three words, y'all. Modern monetary theory will explain. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 22 points today, less than a tenth percent, 24,553. The NASDAQ up 47 points, about six-tenths percent, 7,073. The S&P 500 gained 3 points, about a tenth percent, 26,042. Fairly calm overall. American Airlines rose 6.3% today. Fourth quarter profits beat expectations. Same at Southwest, up 6.25%. However, Southwest chairman did warn that the partial U.S. government shutdown is, quote, disruptive. Delta up about 0.4%. Bristol-Myers Squibb off 1.8% today despite posting strong fourth quarter earnings. Drug maker announced it's pulled its application to have a combination of its lung cancer treatments approved. Celgene, which Bristol-Myers is planning to acquire, is down just a tad. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, I'm Zach, and I listen to Marketplace in Arlington, Virginia. I think what I appreciate the most about Marketplace is their ability to take the economic news of the day, issues such as tariffs, rate hikes, and tax reform, cut through the political noise, and clearly and concisely explain not only how these issues affect our country and the rest of the world, but how they impact people like me. I hope you'll consider joining me as a Marketplace investor and donate today at marketplace.org to help make their work possible.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the newly sworn-in member of Congress from New York, she's gotten all kinds of attention since her upset win in the Democratic primaries last summer. Most of that attention has been political or misogynist or some combination of both. But she said something to Business Insider the other day that struck my economic journalist's ear. AOC, as she's known, is a progressive, and she's got big progressive ideas. And those ideas, just like big conservative ideas, have to be paid for somehow. And what she said was that she thinks something called modern monetary theory, MMT for the in crowd, quote, should be a larger part of our conversation. We took that as an invitation to do an explainer.
I've done it hundreds of times, but in 3 to 5 minutes, it's a fun challenge.
Stephanie Kelton is almost universally acknowledged to be the person to talk to about MMT. In addition to working for the Dems on the Senate Budget Committee, she was an advisor to the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016 as well. And I know that any discussion that puts the words monetary and theory in close proximity is a recipe for radio disaster, which is why I asked Stephanie Kelton to keep it to 30 seconds.
Well, if you're getting the 30-second version, I'll just tell you that maybe for most people, in the simplest possible terms, it's an approach to economics and to understanding the way that a modern economy works. So what it really means is the U.S. government is the issuer of the U.S. dollar. And so the federal government doesn't have to operate its budget like a household does.
To be clear, you are not going to get economists telling you government should run their budgets like a household. What Kelton is saying here is that because the federal government controls how many dollars are out there and can literally, at the push of a button, create more dollars, it shouldn't worry about balancing the money coming in, that is taxes, with the money going out to pay for government programs.
If you control your own currency and you have bills that are coming due, it means you can always pay the bills on time. Mm-hmm. You can never go broke. You can never be forced into bankruptcy. You're nothing like a household.
There is a thing, though, that you got to bear in mind, all that fresh money being created every time you need to pay the bills, inflation, right?
inflation could really become a problem. And that's a legitimate concern and one that we care very much about. Congress could get on a, you know, on a tear and start passing all kinds of ambitious new bills, funding programs, and outstrip the capacity of the economy to keep up. If it doesn't offset some of that spending by raising taxes or reducing spending in some other part of the budget, it might put too much money into the economy and end up causing inflation.
But, says Kelton and modern monetary theory, what Congress giveth, Congress can also taketh away.
So taxes are really a release valve.
All right, so this is the place where I say, I hear you. You're kind of keeping up, but this stuff, Kai, is dense. I got it. So think about a bathroom sink, okay? You got a faucet, you got a drain, standard bathroom sink. Now bear with me here for a minute. Think of the government and its ability to create money whenever it needs to as the faucet. And that bucket area of the sink where the water goes as the economy. And remember that the government controls how much money, that is water, is flowing into the economy, the sink.
The government is creating money to fund programs.
Government needs a couple of billion dollars to pay farm subsidies? Turn the water on. $1 trillion to build a new interstate? Crank that faucet wider.
And so as those dollars reach the economy, they begin to fill up that bucket. And what you want to do is, you know, be very mindful about how full that bucket is getting, because if you overflow the bucket, you're going to get an inflation problem.
Inflation is where the sink overflows.
And if you start to see the water level rising too high and the inflation begins to increase, you can slow the flow of dollars coming into that bucket. That means the government then has to start slowing its rate of spending. Or you can open up the drain and let some of those dollars out of the economy. And that's what we do when we collect taxes. We remove some of those dollars from the economy, and that helps to keep that water balance just right, full employment without inflation.
Maybe what we ought to do is back up here for a second and review how this stuff works now. The people thinking big picture about the economy and keeping that water level steady, Chairman Jay Powell and the gang at the Federal Reserve.
As always, our decisions on monetary policy will be designed to keep the economy on track in light of the changing outlook for jobs and inflation.
Sarah Binder is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's also a professor of political science at George Washington University.
Monetary policy affects the supply of money in the economy, how much money is out there. And monetary policy sets interest rates, the cost to borrow money for individuals, businesses, even banks.
The Fed uses monetary policy to keep that sink we're talking about from getting too empty or too full. The MMT folks, they want Congress to be doing that using fiscal policy.
Fiscal policy boils down to government spending and taxing decisions.
If the MMT crowd was in charge, the Fed would just take a step back, put interest rates real, real low, and leave them there. The catch with this whole thing, of course, sidelining the Fed and controlling inflation with fiscal policy, that is taxes, well, the challenge is political reality. Here's political scientist Sarah Binder one more time.
The making of fiscal policy, it's never neat and tidy. It's not efficient. It has to reflect the interests of different communities across the country, but also has to reflect what the parties want, and then at some level, what's in the nation's interest. So the political constraints on members makes it harder to use fiscal policy and to use tax policy seamlessly.
Or more plainly, depending on Congress to make MMT work, is aspirational, shall we say. And that brings me back to my conversation with Stephanie Kelton. Last question, and then I'll let you go. Do you believe the political atmosphere in this country right now would let any of that happen?
Well, that's tough. Democrats and Republicans don't seem to want to pass legislation of any kind. So I guess I'm not that hopeful in the current climate that we're going to do much more.
We ought to be clear here. It's not that just because the government can print its own money, the debt doesn't matter, or that it's okay for Congress to go crazy funding every whim that it has. MMT, just like Stephanie Kelton said at the beginning, is simply another way to think about all of this stuff. I got to tell you, this is one of those stories where visuals are really going to help. We did a schematic of that sink thing we were talking about. It's online at marketplace.org.
We're going to make it a trifecta today. All three of our moments inside the economic mind of Donald Trump are trade or tariff related, including this tweet. It's from December the 4th last year. This is moment number 8.
I am a tariff man. When people or countries come in and raid the great wealth of our nation, I want them to pay for the privilege of doing so. It will always be the best way to max out our economic power. We are right now taking in billions in tariffs. Make America rich again.
Often the things the president says about this economy are just repetitions of his previous exaggerations or untruths. That's what's going on here in part. We, the government, are taking in billions of dollars in tariffs, as I said earlier. What's not said by the president is that those billions are being paid by American consumers. The real grabber in this one, though, was the first line, "I am a tariff man." It's a paraphrase from William McKinley 120 years ago, the presidential campaign of 1896, when McKinley said, "I am a tariff man standing on a tariff platform." McKinley wins that election. And then he wins again in 1900. But in September of 1901, in his very last speech in Buffalo, New York, the day before he's assassinated, McKinley shows he's had a change of heart. "Commercial wars are unprofitable," he says. "A policy of goodwill and friendly trade relations will prevent reprisals." And yes, I was a history major. Final note on the way out today, in which Valentine's Day this year gets just a little bit less romantic. You know those sweethearts candies? Little hearts with the sayings on them? Love you, L-U-V, or miss you too, the number two? Yeah, they are not going to be available this year. Production problems, it seems, for the company that bought sweethearts from the original manufacturer last year. All right, we are going. The Dow off 22 points today, less than a 10%. NASDAQ up 47, about 0.6%. The S&P 500 gained 3 points. That is a 10%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.